All right. Okay, welcome back. Welcome back to the show. You know, I've been doing People Pleaser more and more sporadically lately. You may have noticed, and I've talked about this on the show. The reason why is because I started a new podcast with my childhood best friend, Kramer England. It's called The Oneer Podcast. That's spelled The O-N-E-R, The Oneer. Okay, that's our podcast. We talk about movies. If that's your thing, if your jam is listening to two nerd boys break down movies at length and give in-depth analysis, then check us out. If that's not your thing, I totally understand. There will still be People Pleaser. There is still my YouTube channel with my video essays. There's still all the stuff that I put on TikTok and Instagram. There's still plenty of the other Austin Archer stuff that you enjoy. But if you do like the occasional movie breakdown, check us out over at The Oneer. We're like 7 episodes deep on this brand new show, and we're having a ball over there. We just did an episode that was Joker Mania, where we broke down all of our favorite Joker cinematic performances throughout history, and then we did an episode breaking down Joker Folie à Deux. A lot of people on the internet have a lot to say about this movie, and so do we. And I'm proud to say that I think our analysis goes into territory and explores areas that other videos and other breakdowns that I've seen do not. I've watched a lot of videos about Joker Folie à Deux, and I do believe that we have some unique takes that have not been seen in other reviews and breakdowns. So check us out. If you are listening on Spotify right now or on Apple Podcasts, you can find The Oneer Podcast. The Oneer, baby. The Oneer, if you don't know what a Oneer is, it kind of looks like owner, O-N-E-R, like the word boner without the B. But a Oneer is like a film term. It refers to a single take in a movie. So like a really long take where the camera does not cut. And speaking of long takes where the camera does not cut, I have a music video that's coming out. It's not for one of my songs. It's for a band called Sego, and I directed and choreographed this music video, and I'm even in it. I'm dancing in it with my friend Kayla Janssen, great choreographer, and we did this project together. My friend Mark Martin shot it. It looks gorgeous. We've got this amazing cast of dancers, and if you are listening to this podcast anytime beyond Wednesday, October 16th, you can go watch it right now. And the reason I'm talking about Oneers and this podcast, and this music video, is because the music video is a 4.5 minute long Oneer, baby. It's all one take. We did the whole thing in one take. Really, really proud of this thing. The band is called Sego, S-E-G-O, and the song is called Tandang, T-A-N-D-A-N-G. Tandang, not sure how to pronounce it, to be honest. I'm not going to lie to you. But it's a great music video. Go check it out. If it's not the 16th yet, then mark your calendar. And Wednesday, the 16th, open up YouTube, type in Sego Tandang, and watch that music video. 4.5 minute long, unbroken one take with great dancing, really cool song. Check it out. Okay, let's get into the show. If you don't know, we have a very important election coming up here in the good old United States of A. And a lot of people are single-issue voters. They have one thing that is kind of their sticking point, whether that's the economy or immigration or the genocide in Gaza. For a lot of people, that single issue is and has been for some time now in the American political landscape, the issue of abortion. I thought, what better way to get into talking about abortion than to just talk about someone who actually has some expertise on the matter, someone who actually has the medical stand, the medical pedigree to talk about it and the medical experience to talk about it. So I brought in this guest today who absolutely crushed. I'm not going to gild the lily too much. I do her entire bio in the interview portion of things. So let's just do it. Let's just get into it. Shall we? Here we go. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser, and today I am talking with Dr. Stacey DeLynn about reproductive freedom. But, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the People Pleaser podcast. I am here with a very exciting guest today. I feel very honored to have this person. I love when I can tackle a topic that I think is important with someone who is absolutely qualified. You sent me in my guest today sent me in a fantastic bio, and I'm just going to read it word for word because this is great. It'll set the stage perfectly for the conversation we're having. Dr. Stacy DeLynn is a board-certified physician and the associate medical director at Planned Parenthood Hudson. Do you say Pasonic or
Pecanic?
Pecanic.
You got it.
That's iconic, Pecanic. Hudson Pecanic in New York. She maintains dual licensure in Florida and New York and has served as a director at Planned Parenthood for 11 years as an abortion provider, gynecologist, and provider of full-spectrum reproductive health care. So we are talking about reproductive freedom. We're talking about abortion. We're talking about a major issue and sticking point for a lot of American voters coming into a crucial election. And I'm just going to go ahead and say this on the outset, that given that bio, I'm going to say that you are more qualified to speak from an academic and experiential place on this topic than probably like at least 90% of the people who are going to be in the audience of this episode. No offense to the listeners or the viewers. I'm just going to say that.
I hope that's why we doctors are here, to be able to hopefully break down all the medical information to make it a little more palatable for everybody who's here to learn.
Well, thank you for agreeing to come in and talk to me about this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I'm glad we got it under the deadline before election day. I don't know at this point in on the calendar how effective any one podcast or piece of content is going to be in swaying any voters, but I'm going to keep doing it until election day regardless. I don't know.
I think there's still a lot of time left, and I think that the decisions that anti-choice politicians are trying to make for people across this country are going to have a really, really big impact. And so hopefully, you know, if there's anybody listening today who thinks maybe the conversation about reproductive rights doesn't affect them, I'm just really happy about the opportunity to explain why it really does affect all of us and how important it is and truly, truly what's at stake. You know, I have the experience of, as you mentioned, being licensed in both New York and Florida. And I am currently not practicing in Florida because of the extremely harsh and strict abortion laws that are there and really, really handcuff doctors from being able to do their job and to be able to uphold that Hippocratic oath and to, you know, really take care of their patients no matter what. And I have this really stark contrast of the two states that I've worked in is one in which I'm able to make decisions for my patients, with my patients in their best interest, versus having anti-choice politicians essentially in the exam room dictating how care is received. And I think that after Roe versus Wade was overturned, I really think that everyone is starting to have these stories and these experiences of what it was like to have themselves or a family member or a friend have something come up in a pregnancy, be it desired or undesired, in a state in which they aren't able to seek the care, the often life-saving care that they absolutely require, having to travel across state lines to get healthcare, those sorts of things. So the stuff I've seen since the fall of Roe versus Wade has been terrifying. And my hope is to get that message out to as many people as possible to understand what's truly at stake.
It's fantastic. And, you know, even just in that initial statement, you've sort of addressed and begun to answer a lot of the topics I want to cover while we talk, which is great. This is for, and it has been for a very long time, but for many voters, this is, you know, we talk a lot about single issue voting and how there are a lot of people who there's like one thing that can sway them. There's a lot of people that'll go, hey, I don't like, you know, I don't like Donald Trump. I don't like his character, but my sticking place is abortion. I have this feeling about the morality or ethics of abortion, whether that's informed by my religious beliefs or just it's just something that feels like a morally or ethically persuasive argument that somehow this amounts to you know a murder. And I want to sort of address that because people have lots of different single issues, whether it's housing insecurity, the economy, immigration. For a lot of voters in this election cycle, it's the genocide going on in Gaza. And for a lot of voters, and as it has been for you know, the last 40, 50 years in American politics, it's abortion. And so I just want to see if we can kind of simplify and break this down, because I think what it comes down to for pro-life or anti-choice voters is this concept of like, what is of the morality of it. So I guess initially I would just ask, like, in a very simplistic way, from a medical standpoint, from the standpoint of your experience, why is safe legal access to abortion important?
It's interesting that you talk about this single issue of abortion, because if you were to interview any doctor, anyone who's gone to medical school or has this experience, you're very, very hard pressed to find an anti-choice doctor, because they understand what abortion is not, you know, when a politician says we're striking down abortion, what exactly does that mean? And what healthcare professionals understand is that the word abortion is incredibly broad. So it can be from terminating an undesired pregnancy. It also covers things like dangerous pregnancies that are put the life and health of the mother at risk, you know, ending a pregnancy that will be non-viable, what we call inevitable miscarriages, in which we know that someone's pregnancy will not continue, but they're bleeding to death at this moment and need immediate care. So, you know, if you actually talk to people and say, like, so are you opposed if you know that a woman is about to have a miscarriage and she's bleeding to death, but technically there's still a fetal heartbeat and she needs immediate surgery to end that pregnancy, you'd be hard pressed to find anyone to say, no, I'm opposed to that, right? No one wants to see a woman bleed to death for no reason. And of course, we've absolutely seen cases of that since Roe versus Wade was overturned. And so when you ask them that, people aren't opposed to that. But the problem is when you legislate this and you have, you know, politicians making decisions on medical issues in which they know nothing about, and there's truly no other place in which politicians insert themselves in the exam room, you have these disastrous consequences. So when it comes to the moral decision as to whether or not a person would want an abortion from themselves in a certain situation, then that's a conversation that people can have and figure out their own morality, and everyone's choices should be respected. But at the end of the day, when it comes to making a legal decision about that, it has absolutely devastating health outcomes that disproportionately impact people who are poor, who don't have access to travel across state lines for like the life-saving healthcare that they need. And you see this real threat to people's health and lives. And so I think when we talk about the moral conversation and then we try to impart it into legislation, it just doesn't work. It's an absolute, like, absolutely dangerous and horrifying situation for patients. And I also think that's what you're starting to see, because, you know, now someone, as I mentioned, might know someone who had an ectopic pregnancy, which is a pregnancy that will rupture a fallopian tube and will absolutely never lead to a viable pregnancy and will kill the person carrying the pregnancy. But now maybe they're opposed to abortion, but they saw someone that they love in Texas have their tube rupture and then bleed and have to be rushed into emergency surgery. So I think that, like, these are the stories that people are starting to understand. And I think that as you're talking about single issue voters, you know, we are seeing across the country people show up for ballot initiatives and people who had maybe never voted before, who maybe weren't as interested in the issue, but now have a personal or, you know, close friendship or family member relationship where they've seen something go terribly wrong. And so, you know, my hope is that people are waking up to this issue now a lot more as maybe something they thought wouldn't affect them, but now they're seeing absolutely does.
Yeah. You know, you talk about these situations of, you know, ectopic pregnancies and people who are, you know, bleeding out in parking lots because they can't get the care that they need, and people who are seeing situations like this. And I think a lot of single issue voters who feel firmly that, you know, abortion is a sticking point for them that leads them to vote more conservatively, who want stricter abortion access and stricter abortion laws around abortion access, it seems like most studies bear out that most of these people do support exceptions. They support exceptions for sexual assault. They support exceptions for things like medically necessary intervention, where you're intervening on behalf of saving the life of the pregnant person. I want you to speak a little bit from a medical perspective on the problem of how to implement cases that necessitate that qualify for an exception, that it's like, why that, you know, I guess the question is, why are a majority of medical professionals pro-choice, or why do they skew pro-choice given all of that information? Yeah, if you could speak about that.
Every patient situation is unique. And so like putting a blanket, we ban abortion. And there are even some states which say like, and we have some exemptions for the health of the mother. It's like, be clear. And a lot of the governors in these states have said, and one of the reasons that I'm not practicing in Florida is like that you can go, that physicians can go to jail for caring for their patients. And so, you know, it's like, it's, you're essentially saying, how do we interpret this law?
Right.
Do we go to court? So when someone is bleeding to death in front of you, do you go then to file a, you know, a petition to further clarify the law? Like, no, you know, we're doctors. We're trained if someone's bleeding to death in front of us that we treat them. And it's so difficult to explain to people, you know, what it would be like to be in that situation. And I really feel for the doctors who are still practicing in these other states to, you know, our agreement is to first help our patients. That's why we went to medical school. That's why we do it. So it's like for us to have to interpret some strange law that doesn't make any sense is obviously a recipe for disaster. And we've seen, you know, patients die in a number of states as expected. And so, you know, it's not our job to interpret what the latest trend that anti-choice politician is following. And I mean, it's, you know, when I started practicing medicine, I never thought that Roe versus Wade would be overturned. And now we're at the point where these laws are so unclear that we're now banning IVF. You know, so in Alabama, the IVF clinics have stopped functioning because there's no clarity on the law. You're essentially calling two cells together in a dish the same as a person and accusing, you know, reproductive endocrinologists who are helping their patients, you know, start the family that they really want and desire. You're calling them criminals and murderers. It's such a bizarre place to be in. And obviously no doctor wants to be in that position. And it's very, very clear if you ask anyone who practices medicine, you know, why this, you know, we go to school to learn, you know, all the ways in which we follow algorithms and practice, you know, we have practice guidelines that we know have been studied and endorsed by societies. And we know that these are the ways to practice medicine. So if you get, you know, a politician who comes in, it's just like, oh, it's all banned. It's just not clear. It's enormously dangerous.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really like, it's one thing to say, I'm totally in favor of exceptions, obviously. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, I favor reasonable exceptions. It's another thing to figure out, well, how are you logistically going about making sure that those exceptions are properly managed when you're threatening medical professionals with jail, with saying, hey, you could be an accessory to murder if you don't get this exception right. If you think that you have a situation that qualifies for one of these exceptions, and we deem that you didn't quite get it just right, we could charge you as an accessory to murder or just charge you for murder. And it's like, well, those are very high stakes for people to try to figure out whether or not their patient qualifies for one of these exceptions or not, you know?
Right. And, like if you have someone who's, you know, if it's, they're saying to save the life of the mother and you have a patient with such severe high blood pressure that you're not, know she's going to have a stroke any minute now, if the pregnancy continues, you know, and you know that you need to treat that dangerous health condition. You could certainly argue that, well, she's not dead yet, you know, like you should have waited it out to see how close she got. I mean, how are you supposed to operate like that? And patients are terrified, you know, and I see the, you know, the terror and concern, and I see a tremendous, practicing in New York, we have a tremendous number of patients who come from out of state and are often scared and confused. And those are the ones who are lucky enough to get to us, who have the financial means to get to us. But, you know, back to the question about your single issue voter who wants abortions to be decreased. What we're seeing is that, like, you know, sometimes abortion care or just a pregnancy test or any step along the way in reproductive healthcare access gets patients in, keeps them healthy, helps them use contraception when they want it. Since these laws have been passed in the states where there's bans, we've seen an increase in the number of abortions, an increase in the number of abortions where patients are getting pills online and, you know, seeking other ways to do it. We're seeing significantly more abortions at later gestational ages because patients who would have had an abortion very early in the pregnancy from the time they missed their first period, now it's taking them months to get to another state. And so it's not having the intended effect. You know, if your goal is to stop abortions, and that's a moral issue for you, the way to do that is to really make healthcare accessible for everyone, to provide people access to doctors, access to contraception, you know, those sorts of things. So that's the route to go if you really have a moral opposition to abortion. This is not the way to do it, and it's making things obviously worse.
It sort of makes me think. I saw a friend post recently on Threads that about capital punishment and the death penalty. This is sort of one of those moral issues of a society trying to debate whether or not it's moral to enforce the idea that murder is bad by murdering people who murder. And like, do the two cancel each other out? Does that work moralistically? But I saw a friend post, if we are going to do capital punishment, if we're going to have the death penalty, it needs to be 100% accurate every single time. We need to know that we are putting an actual murderer to death 100% of the time, or we can't have it at all, because it's not acceptable to have this sort of percentage rate of people falling through the cracks of like, whoops, we accidentally convicted someone wrongly of a crime. And that's not an acceptable sort of contingency in order to have that kind of moral policy as a society. Mm-hmm. And I think it's similar with abortion here, where if you say, hey, I want to make a moral stance here by saying, mm-hmm. I think abortion is morally wrong, so we should outlaw it, knowing that, and even if you say we can write legislation that accounts for certain reasonable exceptions, knowing that people are still going to fall through the cracks, knowing that you are going to have pregnant people who are in dire need of life-saving interventionalist medical care in states with really restrictive abortion laws, where you're going to have people who fall through the cracks and die who could have had their lives saved. And, you know, what winds up happening, as you were alluding to, is higher rates of abortion and higher mortality rates. So if the idea is that you are trying to protect the sanctity of life, you know, how do you square the fact that the result keeps bearing out time and time again, that the result of more restrictive abortion access laws is higher mortality rates, higher infant mortality rates, and higher maternal mortality rates? And could you talk a little bit about that? Why is that? Why do we see higher mortality rates with more restrictive abortion access?
Well, again, I mean, patients are just as scared as some of the doctors that I mentioned talking about. You know, there's even laws in Texas which people can be sued for, like, aiding and abetting someone accessing an abortion. It's purely a fear mentality. So what otherwise might be like a totally manageable condition early in a pregnancy, if a patient knows they're pregnant, doesn't know what they're going to want to do, is scared to even talk about the concept of considering abortion, they, you know, might have a dangerous health condition that they're avoiding doctors to go to. You know, if they have something going on with their pregnancy, they know they can't get care there, and they've decided they can drive to another state, but they've got to find a hotel, they've got to get childcare for their kids. Like, you know, it's taking them weeks to go. This is not the normal, you know, route of things. Like, a patient has a concern, they should be able to talk to their doctor, but their patients are scared. And when they do want care, they're not able to get it in the area in which they live. And, you know, like, you know, back to your point about morals, you know, I'm not an ethicist. I don't, you know, I think everybody is like, makes these moral decisions on their own and comes to those decisions on their own. But what I can tell you from my experience is, like, trying to impart that via some law, it just doesn't work in medicine. Like, medicine is, you know, we come to these series of how we treat patients, like, by a scientific process. You can't, when you try to just insert a moral idea and badly written legislation into it, it just ends up being a total disaster. And so it's like, that's the piece, is like, we really do need to separate how it's not really possible to use morality and try and change a medical protocol, because, you know, these awful conditions will ensue. And I mean, I see them time and time again. You know, I have so many patients with such difficult stories about getting to me. And I also have patients who I've cared for, like, you know, recently I had a patient come from Texas. She was very early in her pregnancy. We couldn't tell if she was still pregnant or not, but she only had 2 days in New York. And so we checked her blood, and she went back to Texas. And, you know, we we got her blood work back and realized that she had ectopic pregnancy, which again is a dangerous pregnancy, will never result in a birth, will always endanger and lead to death of the person carrying the pregnancy. And so when we contacted her and told her, we know from your blood work, you have an ectopic pregnancy, go to the emergency room. No one would take her. Like, she went to the emergency room. They were like, we don't do abortion care. And she's like, I was just told I have an ectopic pregnancy, you know, and she eventually 2 weeks later got someone to drive her to Colorado who helped her get the care that she needed to. And in the process, luckily that ectopic pregnancy didn't rupture. You know, she managed to survive those 2 weeks. We were calling every day. We were trying to help facilitate. She didn't have money to get to Colorado. We were like using, you know, people we knew with abortion funds to help get her there. I just like never really thought when I went to medical school that this would be a part of what I did in medicine, you know, essentially trying to help patients escape the states they're from to be able to get healthcare. So, you know, this is the end result.
That's so dystopic and sad.
It really is.
I have a friend who's a family doctor who in the last 3-4 years has been shifting consistently more and more to the left politically, but for most of our adult lives, he was pretty conservative and pretty right-leaning. And at a camping trip, like 6 or 7 years ago, we were on like a guy's trip camping and this issue came up, and it was a bunch of just like dudes sitting around talking about our thoughts on it. And most of my friends at the time skewed conservative. These are friends that I grew up with in very conservative Sandy, Utah. These are like my Mormon friends that, you know, I love these guys, but I was like one of the only ones that was sort of trying to argue for the pro-choice argument. And then my friend who's the doctor was being really, really quiet. And I said, let's ask him what he thinks. And I said, what's your opinion on abortion? And I'll never forget this, because this was coming from my friend who was, in all other regards, he leaned conservative at this point in his life. But, and I'm convinced that it is because he's a medical professional that he started to shift more and more to the left. But he just said, my opinion is that it exists whether it's legal or not. Like, it's a thing that has to be dealt with by medical professionals, whether legislators want us to or not. Like, we have patients coming in who require this medical care. And we as doctors have to grapple with the moral question of, do not deny someone medical care who you know needs it, who you know it could be potentially life-saving, it could be a life-saving intervention. Do you deny them that to save yourself from potential criminal charges? And having to weigh that question. But he was like, they happen whether they're legal or not. It is a thing that's happened, that has always happened, whether it's been legal or not. It's always been a part of the human story. Like, there are eras in human history where people would just leave infants on this, they'd be like, I can't take care of this baby. And they would just put it in the mud and be like, goodbye. Like, I don't have the resources to take care of you. And that was a real thing that would happen. And like, I don't know, like it has always been part, or, you know, babies that were born and the mother immediately died in the process of giving birth. And it was at a time where there was no one to take care of the infant. And it just, you know,
right. This
has always been a part of our story. And with modern healthcare, it's like, we're trying to figure out how to deal with this reality in the most humane way possible. Right.
And I'm sure like your friend's experience came from the fact that, you know, maybe he was conservative going into it, but like all of us in medical school have to do an OBGYN rotation. Mm-hmm. And in the months that you're on that rotation, you get to see like the fun joy of delivering babies. And you also get to see all the things that go wrong, because as you mentioned, like for most of human history, either the mother or the child died as a part of childbirth, right? Like that, you know, it's only a fairly recent invention that we were able to help people survive through a pregnancy. So, you know, it can be, and most of the time, most pregnancies go well. But there are a lot of things that you as a medical student are going to see from the get-go, like, oh, wow, if this woman tries to, you know, progress in her pregnancy, she'll die, no question. You know, so I'm sure your friend had that exposure to know. And so, you know, that's why it's easy for doctors to be like, well, yeah, you obviously can't, people will just die if you try to ban abortion. It's not such a straightforward thing. And, you know, like also historically, I remember when I was in medical school, I had a much older doctor who was one of my attendings, one of the doctors training me. And he was practicing in the era of Roe versus Wade. And, you know, he was actually telling me that he thought people were getting, you know, too glib about abortion rights. And he was like, I worry that we'll go back to a place where we don't have the med students like you. You've always known that it was there and an ability. But he told me, you know, horror stories of women coming in just like absolutely bleeding to death from a botched abortion that was done on a kitchen table somewhere. And he was like very, very emphatic that all of the students in the rotation like understood the importance of abortion care. And, you know, at the time I was like, wow, that's really sad. Thank God we'll never be back there. You know, we have everything set and tucked away now. And as I mentioned before, you know, I never thought we would be in a place where Roe versus Wade would be overturned. But now we're in a place where so quickly at such a quick pace, we're seeing state after state put in these really, really harmful restrictions. And, you know, I think we're also in a place where the people who have managed to push these restrictions are not anywhere near done yet. And, you know, I think we could absolutely face a national ban on abortion. We could see national restrictions that pick various weeks of gestation, which again, you know, in no way addresses what an actual parent's health condition is at that time. You know, that I think that we're at a place where we may not have even seen the beginning of it yet. And so I think like I really feel strongly about letting people know what it's like to see this fall and see what it actually means for people in this country.
You know, having, you know, kind of being involved in political advocacy for the last several years of my life, I've always sort of been involved with it in one way or another, but I've only had the platform for like the last 5 years. But I've gotten to see kind of the way that people who seem to be single issue voters on this or seem to stick on an issue like this, the way that they respond to different kinds of arguments. And I'm sure you have too, working with Planned Parenthood for as long as you have and advocating on this topic for as long as you have. I know that there are a lot of people who will listen to the first half of this episode, or if they will listen to it at all, and they'll just go, you're saying a lot of words and I hear all that, but really all I care about is the fact that to me it's murder. That's what it, and it's mm-hmm. sort of like the brain can sort of dismiss every other argument or every other reasoning around that, because the sticking point is murder is bad and I will always come down on mm-hmm. this equals murder and murder is wrong. Yeah. In your experience, is there a way to effectively reason with that position or argue against that position? Is there a way to medically or in any clear way try to grapple with that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that comes to my mind is like my grandmother. She was a devout Catholic. She just passed away at 99, and she was a Catholic her whole life. You know, went to church multiple times per week. And you know, when I started working at Planned Parenthood, I was like a little anxious about telling her, and so I thought that she might be upset because I knew what a strong Catholic she was and how important it was to her. And she said, you know, I said, I hope this doesn't make you upset that I work here. And she was like, she told me a story about when she was a young girl in her 20s. She had a very, very close friend who had to get an abortion in the back of a restaurant. It was a restaurant at night that had been closed. And she heard her friend scream. And then her friend got a terrible infection just barely survived. And so from that point on, she started to realize that maybe when the Catholic Church said abortion is wrong in any circumstances, she thought about her friend. And then my mom is an only child, and you know, the Catholic edict is to have many, many children. And when my grandmother delivered my mom, she had a C-section, which was pretty rare at that time in the 50s. And she almost died from a very severe hemorrhage. She was hospitalized for many weeks and barely survived. And afterwards they had talked to the doctor had said, it's probably not safe for you to have any more children, you know, it could kill you. And so afterwards, you know, they talked to the priest about it, and the priest was like, well, the goal is to always, and she was like, and I talked to your grandpa and we were just like, it's not worth it for me to die to have another baby. And so like, that's kind of a long-winded answer to say, people may have an idea of like, this one thing is wrong. And, you know, I think the sad piece is that just like more and more people realize what it actually means. And that if they, and they may even still hear other people's stories and not care. And then when they decide to carry a pregnancy of their own, you know, may have to make a decision to give up their own health and life in order to carry a pregnancy. And that may eventually start to change. And I hope that never happens. I hope these conversations are enough. But like sometimes though, I think that that's the place we may end up being in where you have to change people's minds. And again, my grandma, a devout Catholic till the day that she died, but understood the nuance and understood the reason that, you know, keeping the people around us alive is more important than this kind of moral idea.
Would it be an accurate summation then that maybe the rejoinder to that position or the response to that position could be, okay, I hear you. You have a moral, you feel a moral responsibility toward the sanctity and dignity of human life. And that's why anything that feels like it approaches the concept of murder to you is you cannot abide. If the sticking point is human life is sacred, human life needs to be defended, the data bears out that safe legal access to abortion
is actually pro-life.
Yeah, protects and saves more life than restrictive abortion laws.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of the day.
I think that's kind of the only thing that can, I think that's the only thing that can be said to that. If a person is, because personally, I think there's also other arguments. There's other territory we could get into about like, I don't know, like when do you consider personhood and people, right. It's really hard to determine.
And that. I get that these are like super personal decisions for, right. And I daily have a patient who comes in and says, I'm pregnant. I'm not sure what to do about it. And that's like a great place to explore that for that person and for, you know, for that. What does a pregnancy mean to them? What does it mean to them to carry a pregnancy? You know, we provide as much prenatal care as we do abortion care at Planned Parenthood. You know, and so I think that's such an individual decision for every person. And I really encourage people to have their own opinions about it and, you know, and to work it out through their own series of, you know, ethical and moral considerations. What I'm here to talk about is when you try to say, these are my morals, let's make a law about it and implement it, what it actually leads to. And it doesn't, it actually leads to threats to people's lives. It's actually, you know, an anti-life position to put these laws into place because they lead to a lot of really, really sad stories, a lot of sickness, a lot of pain, and even death.
Yeah, we have a person in the comments who just said, unfortunately, data does not work on people who are using faith or their arbitrary for their arbitrary morality as an argument.
Right. And that's back to that personal stories part, though, too. Like, right. You know, you've probably read the data of when you see, you know, you see that 1,000 people died in a war bombing, it may not mean anything to you. And then you see the picture of that one child affected by the bombing, right? And it really moves you. And I think that that's what I'm talking about is like, we're now seeing so many of these examples for people saying, you know, abortion, it's always wrong, no exceptions. And then they have a friend who bleeds to death in the parking lot, you know, which is cases that we've seen where a hospital won't treat them because they're technically still pregnant while they're bleeding to death. Like that may, knowing that story may move someone, but I hope we can just keep having these conversations and not have to have more of those stories.
Yeah, I used to, and I have on this podcast before many times and on my channel and in different videos many times, tried to use the argument for the importance of ideological pluralism, because it is like you get to a certain point where you can't really parse out if you try to make a scientific or a medical argument about when does personhood arrive. And I think that there is a good argument to say maybe at the point when a fetus is viable outside of the womb, if it can live on its own outside of its host, then it can be considered a person that could potentially function and live. I just want to say
just as a quick aside in the recent presidential debates where, you know, there was conversation that what abortion is delivering a live human child. And then, I don't know, somehow killing it in the corner. Like, I'm surprised we have to say this, but that's not at all what abortion is. There's no state anywhere, or I think country, where it's legal to murder an infant. So, you know, just so that we're clear, just as a quick aside, I can't believe we have to address this, but yeah, that's actually not what abortion is.
Yeah. Post-birth execution is not legal.
Not a thing.
Yeah, it has not been.
Here we are, happy to talk about this.
if we are going to sidestep into this, I'm totally all right with this. Maybe we can just sidestep into what I think people are hearing when they hear that, the stories that they're hearing and that they're latching onto, the stories that Donald Trump is hearing and that he's repeating. They are talking about, I believe, palliative care in the instance of like an infant being born and it being clear that this baby is probably not going to survive much longer than, you know, like you know, almost like how you would approach end of life care for a person in hospice who's terminally ill, you know, late in life. Could you talk a little bit about that from a medical standpoint? Because that might be what people are pointing at and saying,
Yeah. I mean, that's not my area of expertise, but there's neonatal pediatricians who specialize in that sort of thing. You know, for in this abortion conversation, when we know that a fetus will not, if delivered, will not be viable because of genetic or anatomic malformations. You know, some parents do choose to have an abortion. Some parents do choose to deliver that baby at full term. And that is a service that's offered, like palliative care for babies who would not otherwise live. But I mean, I think that is being talked about as what abortion is. And what abortion is essentially very similar to inducing a period in the first trimester of pregnancy. You know, 8% of abortions are done in the first trimester. And for abortions that are done in the second trimester, most of those cases are cases of, as we mentioned, you know, for example, an anatomy scan, which scans for major fetal abnormalities, isn't done until the second trimester. So that's identified. Or there are, you know, more and more cases that we see now where patients are trying to get abortion care in the states that they live in, cannot, and are seeking, you know, that later abortion care in those states. But those are very, very distinct things. And it's upsetting to see those things being muddled.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that's really good to clarify allowing a, you know, some new parents who are dealing with the fact that they have been told that their unborn fetus is not going to be viable upon, birthing out of the womb, allowing them to go through that process and offering palliative care is not the same thing as abortion. Those are two different things.
Right. That
is
absolutely not the same. Not.
Yeah. And,
these are really, really complex, difficult situations that, you know, I have worked through with grieving parents before. And, you know, it took me 4 years of college, 4 years of med school, 4 years of residency, many years of practice to like be able to handle these situations individually, and getting to know my patients and helping them through these difficult processes. Once again, a law saying like, we're going to figure out where all this stops and where this starts, and we don't care about any of the nuance. It's just, it's really tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to this, I was bringing up this idea of ideological pluralism, and I want to get your take on this. Basically, the argument that I would use is like, okay, we're not going to be able to convince each other when a personhood is gained in the process of a fetus developing, because there are religious beliefs about a soul being delivered down from heaven. And I really don't want to like shit on anyone's religious belief and say, that's stupid, that's unscientific. It's like, cool, you believe that there is a person being sent with a purpose from a divine creator. And I can't really get into, a medical argument with you about when personhood begins or when the soul enters into the body. And I don't really know if I want to get into that argument, but what I could approach is a concept of ideological pluralism, that we exist in an ideologically plural society, that we have a lot of differing views on the nature of life and personhood, and we want to have laws that honor our ideological pluralism. In other words, the vast majority of us agree that, like, when there is a living, breathing person looking at you and talking to you, if you kill that person, that is morally wrong. There's not a whole lot of like ideological plurality on whether or not that's wrong. We agree that like we don't. That is an antisocial behavior that we do not want to tolerate. We do have, though, a lot of plurality on the question of the morality and ethics of abortion and everything that it entails. And my argument has been, and I want, this is what I want to get your thoughts on. Sorry, long setup here. My argument has been the only way to honor ideological plurality is to have safe legal access to abortion. I know that that seems like I'm saying my way over your way, but that is the only option that allows us both to retain our different beliefs and to live our life. Because you still get to, as a person who believes it's morally and ethically wrong, say, I will never do that. I will never, you know, and that, and there's no law preventing you from doing that. In the other instance, you are forcing everyone else that does not share your personal religious convictions to abide by laws that are written in accordance with your religious convictions. You're forcing us to live under your theocratic laws. And that's, you know, so it's sort of like inherently anti-democratic in that way. And I wonder what your take is on that.
Well, it's just to like bring it back to this concept that the problem with imbuing morality into law means that, like, in Alabama, the law that's present is like two cells in a petri dish for IVF is the exact same. If you were to smash that dish, there's no difference between that and murdering a small child in front of you. Like, it unfortunately, it's so poorly done and so poorly written that this attempt to push this moral idea or this concept that you might believe in your religion ends up in this place where it just really harms people. And so, you know, it's a great idea to have your morality be reflected everywhere you were. But as you mentioned, that's a theocracy. And, you know, the concept of pro-choice means the ability to make the choice based on what your moral compass is. And I think that we need to be able to have that and continue that for everyone, but recognize the actual real world life results of what happens when you try to push those morals into poorly written laws.
Yeah. You've mentioned IVF a few times now, and a big part of this debate in politics and when it comes to the different forms of legislation that are sort of pushing and pulling against each other is also the concept of trying to get rid of or put stricter access on different forms of contraception. And in that gets woven into that conversation, IVF gets woven in there. And I think, yeah, really quickly, this all starts to become the moral question of when does viability or when does personhood or when does life begin starts getting pulled into the fray of, like, it starts to feel more and more arbitrary, because it's like, If all we're talking about is the potential of something that could grow into a human being, then, like, at a certain point, getting your period is tantamount to murder because you're shedding eggs that could have been fertilized. And, you know, like, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about contraception and, like, what a world looks like without comprehensive contraception. And yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, unfortunately, that's just the trend that we see. It's like it's like an old tale at this point. They like make it just about like, oh, we think it's just these very, these examples of abortion in which, you know, we think this is wrong. And then it kind of creeps more and more and more. To be honest, I was fairly surprised to see the IVF discussion come up. That was a surprise for me, but contraception has always been part of this. And, you know, it seems, it begins to feel like it's really about controlling, you know, people with uteruses and their bodies and what they're able to do. And so, you know, as shortly after the conversation about abortion becomes emergency contraception, and they start referring to that as abortion, which it's absolutely not. You know, it prevents a pregnancy from happening. And as you mentioned, contraception as an idea, and it's like, it's truly like, where does it stop? And that's the problem with this sort of theocratic argument, is that it doesn't tend to stop and really, really has impacts on people's lives. You know, and we do see a lot of states where state Medicaid, state government health insurance programs are covering contraception less and less, and making it more and more difficult to get contraception. So it never stops at this point, right? Like, it always continues on. And so I think that's people, again, may think like, oh, they're passing this abortion law, I don't think that it would affect me, I'm on birth control. And so it's like, well, what if that wasn't available, or what if it was harder to access? And so, You know, again, it's just, it's really just anytime you try to legislate these instances in which a person makes a decision for themselves and for their health and their bodies. And by the way, contraception is used for a lot of other things besides preventing pregnancies, painful periods, endometriosis, you know, the list goes on and on. And so, once again, when you're saying that, states won't cover certain types of contraception, in their insurance policies, it's like, okay, you know, it's not just for preventing pregnancies, what's it for? And these are things that doctors know and patients know that, but that very often legislators don't have any idea about.
And I think this is where we get, you know, labels like anti-choice or forced birth, because this, you know, I think that sometimes people who are going back and forth in comment sections on the internet and trying to have, you know, like mudslinging political debates and stuff about their differing ideologies and positions, they kind of just, I think there's this idea that like, oh, well, you just say anti-choice because you want to take away my stance, which is actually pro-life and about the sanctity of life. But it's like, no, the word anti-choice isn't just meant as an insult to someone who believes their stance is pro-life. It's very specifically, it comes from this idea that things like taking away access to contraception, you're taking away all options that people have, and things saying forced birth, it's like the state is mandating that if you are going to be sexually active, we want those eggs fertilized and we want you carrying that thing to term, and we want to make that a matter of legal record that like you have to do that if you're going to be
And let's not ignore the fact that like the legislation only goes so far, right? That there are patients who certainly will be forced into forced birth, but everyone knows that if someone who's pregnant doesn't want to be, for the most part, they will find a way to do it. And what we want is for patients who don't want to be pregnant to be able to have access to a doctor when they need it. Mm-hmm. Like full stop, patients will find ways to do it. And, you know, everyone knows now that patients are getting abortion pills online, which again, maybe many patients are able to self-manage their abortions, but if they want to talk to a doctor, they should be able to. So, you know, it's also when you say these laws, like let's pass this law that does this, not only does it have all of the implications that we already talked about, but also doesn't really work, right? People who don't want to be pregnant will do everything they can to not be pregnant. So, you know, it's whether or not they're able to have safe access to that care and access to a doctor when they want it.
It almost makes me think of like harm reduction tactics when it comes to dealing with drug addiction. I know these are like wildly different topics, but it's sort of the same. It comes, the debate over the issue comes from the same place of morals, where a lot of people go, well, doing drugs is morally wrong. It's a sign of low moral character and low moral fiber. We shouldn't be taking care of people and offering them safe ways to do heroin. Mm-hmm. But the idea of harm reduction and offering, you know, clinics where people can come and do safe intravenous drugs and making sure they're not overdosing on fentanyl. The idea is this is happening. It is the reality of the situation. People who want to do heroin are doing heroin regardless of its legal status. Mm-hmm. We are trying to implement ideas that will reduce harm, will provide the safest possible way for that to happen. And I think that's an interesting argument, especially approaching the concept of morals and ethics, where it's like if the idea here is morality, if the idea here is putting a premium on the sanctity and the dignity of human life, then I think there's a really solid moral argument to be made about harm reduction. That it's like, okay, cool. You think that the idea of someone having sex that outside of marriage or outside of the desire to become pregnant, that that's a sign of low moral character. That the idea of someone not wanting a pregnancy for whatever reason is a sign of low moral character. It's happening regardless of your personal character assessment of that person. It's going to happen regardless of what you think of the ethics and morals of that person. Can't we now have a system in place that is designed to make sure the least possible harm is done?
Right. And that's like doctors learn. It's like first do no harm. That's our obligation to our patients. And if you were to ask any doctor about the same thing when it comes to, you know, dangerous substance use, again, the first thing that we want to do is get a patient to a doctor. And, you know, that's across the board for any health condition. And we know how to approach each individual health condition as its own thing. Each patient as their own person. And so, you know, the more that we can provide access to healthcare for everyone, accessible healthcare, whether it be any kind of healthcare or, you know, again, full spectrum reproductive healthcare, that's what we want for our patients, is to be able to reach us when they need us.
Dr. DeLynn, this has been fantastic. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to do this. My last thing that I'm curious about, and I don't know how comfortable you are speaking on this. What is your, we've kind of run the gamut of like the medical perspective and, you know, what all of your experience tells you and personal stories. What is just your personal assessment of the ethics and morals of reproductive health care and abortion?
I mean, I, you know, first used a Planned Parenthood when I was a teenager. I grew up in like a very conservative town and in very religious home. And I like knew that Planned Parenthood was the only place where I could go and get, you know, confidential care that, and where I could have my questions answered. And I was able to access birth control that led me to be able to go to college and eventually to medical school. And so, you know, I always had, you know, as I went to school, I always sort of had this, this political opinion and this idea that, you know, one of my goals was to end suffering in the world and to help people who needed it. And, you know, as I got more into college and more interested in the sciences and medicine, you know, and had that rotation, you know, early on with that doctor who talked about the issues facing women and lack of access to safe abortion care, I just sort of knew that was my calling. And so straight out of residency, I went to work for Planned Parenthood. And I unfortunately see abortion care as very often in the US siloed and sort of like you have to go to a Planned Parenthood in order to get abortion care. And as a quick aside, you know, all these states that are banning abortion care, they're also limiting their doctors who are training to become doctors in those states, their access to learning about those things. And so, you know, I think that my you know, I just really wanted to be able to give back to an organization that had given so much to me when I was young. And I think that having access to reproductive healthcare allows people to live their full potential and their full lives. And so I've sort of just always worked for Planned Parenthood and never looked back. And my goal is to continue to just like be here every day for patients, regardless of what their decisions are, wherever I can meet them. You know, I want to be there to help. And so that's just sort of that's my opinion on it. And it's a very simple and easy decision for me. I feel incredibly empowered by the work that I do. And you'll talk to a lot of doctors, especially in America, who are burnout in healthcare. But for me, like every single day, I have a patient tell me, like, thank you so much. You really helped me in a difficult time in my life. And so, you know, I feel like it's a real honor to be able to do the work that I do.
That's fantastic. And you know, thank you for doing the work that you do. Thank you for being out there on the front lines of that and, you know, keep continuing to fight the good fight in the face of so many people who genuinely just are not qualified to be telling you what you should be doing from a medical standpoint. And you continue to do it anyway, because the bottom line of it is you do know better than they do. and also, I think that there is a very valid humanitarian and humanistic argument as to why this is a more moral and ethical position to have, and a way to operate from a medical standpoint and from a humanistic standpoint. So thank you for doing what you do.
And thank you so much for like helping get the word out. This is like a really important and pivotal time right now. I also just wanted to point out too that across the country there's a number of ballot initiatives, and these are like in the last midterms they already passed in places like Kentucky, these places that you would think were so conservative and go one way, but already like a lot of people are seeing the impact of this and wanting to you know, by and large, people are pro-choice across this country. And so, you know, I live in New York where we have Prop 1, which will help really, really enshrine abortion rights into the Constitution here. My home state where I'm from in Florida, there's a Proposition 4, since Florida has had like a 6-week ban, which is before patients even realize that they're pregnant. These are really important ones to pay attention to. I know you have listeners from all over the country. If you are in a state that practices direct democracy. There are 20 states across the country that have already put really severe and harsh abortion restrictions in place that are really damaging. So please, that's another way for you this election cycle to just kind of keep an eye out and help enshrine abortion rights into your state law, which with the up in the air national election coming up, that might be something that we need to really do on a sort of a grassroots organizing level across the country.
Absolutely. Is there anywhere that people can follow you if they would like to and learn more about the work that you do?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at StacyDelin_MD.
Fantastic. StacyDelin_MD. Dr. Stacy DeLin, thank you so much for joining me today. Really, really appreciate your insight. And
thanks so much.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. See you later, everybody. We'll see you at the next one. Bye-bye. So there it is, my friends. If that did anything for you, let me know. If there was anything in there that you thought, oh, that's useful. If there was any piece of information that you thought, ooh, that's what I can share with my friends or family members who are stuck on this issue. Or, ooh, that enlightened something for me, a person who has been personally stuck on this issue that I hadn't thought of before. You know, let me know. I'd like to hear that stuff. And make sure you're registered to vote, vote.gov. Go out there and make sure that you are ready and prepared and that you have a plan to vote. And I'll probably do one more of these episodes before the election, and then we'll see on the other side of it. Win or lose, whatever happens, we'll get through it together. We'll sure try. Check out the Oneer podcast, all that good stuff. Check out the music video for that I directed and choreographed with my friend Kayla Janssen for the band Sego. Sego is spelled S-E-G-O. The song is spelled T-A-N-D-A-N-G, Tandang. It's really cool. It's really awesome. It's all in one shot. It's 4.5 minutes long of one shot and amazing dancing, amazing choreography. Check us out, dude. And we'll see you next time. Okay, People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by your boy. Go to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com to check out my music and support this show. Patreon.com/AustinArcher is also a thing that you can do if you want to support what we do here. Shout out to the Patreon patrons. You are the wind beneath my wings. You are the coolest people ever, and I love you all very much. Thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for being so generous, and we'll see you next time. Until then, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.